Hello, I'm Susan Flory, and this is The Big Middle, big thoughts from big thinkers about the healthy longevity revolution. What happens when your kids, all grown up, don't call, don't visit, don't care? Had things gone to plan, you'd be hearing an answer from a friend I'll call Beth, 52, mother of three, and desperately sad. Her eldest, now 32 and flying high as an oncologist, never calls, never visits, and openly tells her father, sister, and brother she has no interest in having a relationship with her mother. Was there a cataclysmic rupture in their relationship, an event that Beth can identify? No. Has she tried every which way to get her daughter to open up, tell her why she's being shunned? Yes, says Beth. She's also suggested they see a therapist. Not even a no to that one. There was no response. Coming on this podcast anonymously was too hard for Beth. Her life on this topic is cloaked by heartache and confusion. This is a little reported flaw in the fantasy happy families social script we're all fed. The advent of the big middle years does not mean there's less drama and more love and respect in both directions. My interest in this is born of comments from Beth and two other friends in their 50s with grown-up children. In the last year, all surprised me with, Susan, I wish I'd never had them. They couldn't care less about me. I only hear from them when they want something. I know why they felt they could share that with me without judgment. They weren't toss-off comments after an argument. I love kids, but never felt in a hurry to make my own. That ambivalence held through a succession of international jobs, miscarriages, and the cancer death of my beloved in my mid-40s. It is harder to share the dark reality that your kids have abandoned you with friends living that happy family's fantasy. You know, enduring mutual love and support and so much fun had by all whenever you're all together. That's my springboard to take a wider look at the flaws in that script. Our guide is Rachel Melville Thomas, an adolescent psychotherapist of 30 years' experience in the UK, the US, France, and Switzerland. Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Susan. Good to be here.
So pleased to get your insights on this. How does that story, the story of Beth, hit you, Rachel? I mean, is it exceptional in your experience or more common than we might imagine?
It's a terribly sad story, isn't it? But unfortunately, way more common than we imagine. I think there are all kinds of life events that happen within a family that cause rifts and people to separate in this way. And I guess, you know, as a psychotherapist, I'd be looking at Beth's story and thinking, you know, what is going on here? And what has actually caused this? I suppose one of the ways I work is to look back into the earlier part of the family life and think about what happened with relationships early on. How does her daughter see the problem? Where's the cause of it? And I guess I was looking back and thinking about, how was there something missed? Was there an opportunity to understand what her daughter needed or wanted? Was Beth forced into behaving in a certain way? And I'd like to know a little bit more about that.
Well, I do think I know, because she's a very dear friend, and I know that there was a lot of disharmony between the parents even early on. But I've also seen the videos, amazing birthday parties and birthday cakes and homemade clothes and love, love, love and all of that. But I do know that the husband was quite dictatorial, a little bit older. They actually divorced when their daughter was 14. And I am told, of course, I'm only getting Beth's side of the story. That's got to be made clear. But Dad was, you know, high flyer in high finance. He became the instant favorite of all three of the kids, including the eldest daughter. And, you know, there were lots of exotic holidays at five-star hotels and shopping expeditions to Paris and Milan and, you know, housewife mom who had the first child at 19 was pretty much discounted. I mean, would divorce be one of the most common reasons for this sort of collapse, long-term inexplicable collapse of a parent-child relationship?
It certainly could be. But what even more interesting is what time of the child's life did the divorce happen? So at 14, just think about it, you're starting adolescent life, and ask, what are a teenager's wants and aspirations, maybe to look good, maybe to feel pretty, maybe to have things. And if you are feeling upset and fed up about your parents separating, then perhaps you fill in the void with a lot of those special events and special trips, as you were describing, which would unfortunately make the parent who's giving them have a perhaps more attractive look to them. So I think the timing of divorce is really important. If you divorce when they're 8, that means one thing. When you're divorced when they're 14, it's something else. Divorce when they're 19, that's something else again. So I'd really be trying to think about what was going on, you know, what was perceived, as you say, giving gifts and trips and things seems to be very attractive on a very superficial level, but it's more likely that early teenagers, 13, 14, are going to be drawn into that as a value that they really want. And I also want to, if you're 14 years old and you're looking at your parents divorcing, maybe the parents have all kinds of complex reasons why they're separating. What does a teenager think? What does a teenager perceive is the cause? Was it that mom was unfair to dad, or dad wasn't really paying attention, or was anybody noticing her at all? So it's kind of interesting. As adults, I think we're very clear whether we're the injured party or the person who decided that was enough. But a teenager and a much younger child will see things very differently. So I'd be wanting to explore that and find out perhaps parents caught up in so much pain and hurt and distress that they weren't able to see how the children were taking it. And that's no fault of their own. I think it's very hard for us.
Well, they weren't a tight couple. You know, dad ruled the roost. He would contradict mom's idea on things. I mean, this is what I've heard from my friend over the years, because, you know, her heart's pretty much shredded with this long, ambiguous distance that's happened with her eldest daughter. So I do know that they weren't that tight couple that discussed their approach to everything. It was just mom would say one thing, dad would come home and contradict that.
I'm also really fascinated in the personality of the father. If I was objectively meeting this family, I'd be wanting to know what kind of a person he is and how he views life. And I'm wondering, and this is absolute speculation, I have no disrespect to the reality of Beth's story, but whether he, as a successful person, was a bit kind of black and white and all or nothing, so that things are sold very quickly. And maybe I wonder whether his daughter is a little bit like that. So she seems to have behaved in that kind of just simply switching off her mom because that's not convenient. And I just wonder if there are echoes of personality that would have genetically been shared from dad to daughter.
Oh, that's very insightful from what I know. The disunity in parenting approach, different values. Beth wanted her youngest to get a summer job because that was what she did when she was young. She got a summer job. Her parents said, well, of course, like my parents did. You're 14. You need a little Saturday job to give you some spending money. And he wasn't like that at all. But my kids don't have to work. You know, they just didn't have the same approach to parenting. So I think that showed, well, exactly what you said. And because daddy was seen as the one who financed them and who gave them all these luxuries and treats, well, he was definitely more attractive. And I think you could quite rightly say he bought their affection.
And at a time when they were ready to be bought. That's my point, I suppose. So much, much younger children might be initially entertained by trips to Disneyland or toys and stuff like that. But actually what they want is the comfort of the parent who can listen to them and be with them. I think teenagers are kind of moved into a different world.
And they're also finding themselves, as you said. You know, she has adopted the outlook of her dad, maybe, and just black, white, no gray. Mom is less useful to me now. Dad, love you to bits.
Yes, exactly. I think that's my speculation. As I said, I don't know the details of the family, but I would be looking for. It's always interesting to see how our children reflect one or other of us parents, because obviously there's genetic influence. People have different levels of anxiety, for example. We've had different life experiences. If you've had a difficult life experience as a child growing up, you're more likely to be a parent who wants to make sure that your child has homes and holidays and gifts because perhaps you never had them. And your values may be very much hanging on feeling comforted by things. So maybe that's the dad, maybe, or we all have friends who will say, yes, you know, I never had much when I was growing up, so I'm going to make sure my children do. And then your child grows up with those values. I think differences in values between parents can be very difficult in ordinary family situations. And then when you're actually looking at these estrangement situations, I think values, differences in values causes a lot of distance between parents and their grown-up children.
Yeah, and you can lather your children with love, but if someone is working against that in different ways, it only goes for so much in the long run.
I think it's hard to, without knowing the family and the mum and the dad, to understand how love worked in that family. What do people value? See, what did they like? Having some people just want to curl up on a sofa with their mum and watch a movie, and another person wants to have new footballs bought for them or better trainers, and then somebody else wants them to, you to sit with them and help them with their homework. So there's lots of different expressions of care and love, and children take it in different ways. And as you get to teenage years, they shift. Oh my gosh, they shift.
Yeah, I suppose, because they're finding their way in the wider world. It's not just the home front and the parents that are the ones that are giving them their personal context.
I think you find that teenagers will, first of all, I always think the rule with teenagers is everybody, every one of them is more vulnerable than they appear. That's just a sort of rule of thumb. Even if you have a apparently confident, very outgoing, social, clever teenager, there is a vulnerability there simply because of the developmental stage where everything's changing. So what are you going to do about that vulnerability? Do you express it? Makes you kind of quite kind and compassionate to other friends who are having a rough time? Or do you hide it by being bigger, better, cooler than others? I mean, I'm a child and adolescent therapist. I work with families who have teenagers who are clearly covering up. They look great, but underneath it's not so great. And it just doesn't, I this lovely mum, Beth, who has tried to be loving to her children, something just didn't quite, something got missed with how perhaps the parents together or separately were able to really understand what those kids needed. And now it's got stuck years later in an adult young person, kind of really stuck in a very old grievance, I think.
Yes, and the sad thing is that try as she might, as she's told me, to encourage the daughter to talk it out with her. Let's even if you want to get therapy, let's get to the nub of this. No response, just met with silence. So, I mean, there is something deep-seated there. And the daughter is now 32 years old. She's a high-flying oncologist. She's done really well with her education. She's enjoying her adult life. And you know, whatever the resentment is, whatever the trigger point was for this behavior that has now become embedded in their relationship, the daughter's living her life and mom's, you know, in the shade now.
Yes. And, you know, you just said, Susan, that she's living a professional life, which is very successful, and that she's enjoying her life. I don't think, think about the teenage rule. You never know what's going on underneath, and you never know how much somebody is or isn't enjoying their life, in quotes. So I would say she, the daughter has decided one way or another that it's less painful to not go into a relationship or to reconnect with her mum, perhaps because it's going to bring up painful losses, grief even, sadness, things that she missed, things that she wished were there. Sometimes people just feel like it's safer to pull a big heavy shutter down, like on the shop front, you know, just shut it down, and I'm going to keep all the sadness, the I wish, the regret, the looking back. I'm not going to deal with it. And, you know, there are some, I don't know, I'm really speculating here, but there are some professions which are better for you to go into if you're good at that. And I'd say some surgery or some kinds of very high flying scientific professions are good ones where you can be clear and helpful and rational, but you just don't go into vulnerable feelings. It's not safe. And you don't
maybe
do
that's just her. That's how she has evolved, born of her experience. As you said at the outset, every child is different.
And she's doing what keeps her going, what the daughter keeps her going. So, you know, we're then left with Beth, who is baffled. But what I think I'm a little wary of is balancing the I've given you everything parties material or whatever over the years. We've done the best we could at the time, but something just slipped. And the joy of thinking about these things, I don't think anything is irrecoverable. I think there's always a chance to recover something that has slipped, to look back and think, what was it? What was it that I missed there? And is there a chance for some kind of reparation or understanding now that we're all grown-ups, now that we're all adults?
Yeah, so there is, so you can rest on the hope that maybe in the future the relationship will cycle back into something that is more harmonious, or even any contact whatsoever, you know, family gatherings, birthdays, things like that. I mean, I know Beth just doesn't see her daughter, doesn't hear from her daughter. The family birthday dinners are only four people when there should ideally be five people around the table. But I know you have something to say about family myths, Rachel. You know, the expectations we've got aren't necessarily the ones we should have.
That's right. I think obviously I'm sort of moving away from Beth's story for a second here, because thinking more widely about the problems of estrangement, what we need to look at is what have we been saying to our kids that we may not even have realized was a message along the lines of, well, I'm raising you so that you will be the successful businesswoman that I never was, or you will be the sports person that I never was, or the other way around, you will be exactly the sports person that I was, so you will carry on. I mean, it's a very powerful genetic thing, isn't it? If you have offspring, you want them to be reflect you in some way. Now, to say the corollary of that is, can you let them go? That's really a very big part of this picture. So if you're raising children to perhaps fulfill some wishes and dreams, that can actually go sour later because they don't want to. That brings me back to the values question. Or the idea that you owe me. I've given you a house over your head. I've given you, I've given you material things. I've been there for you all this time. So you owe me, you owe it to look after me. Now, in the Western culture, this doesn't work. It really works in Asian and Chinese cultures that you do owe your parents. You owe it to them to look after them in their old age. We really are in much more individual families. We don't we don't do that.
Well, I was digging into this, of course, in my library of Google, you know, is so interesting, so vast. And I was looking into the Confucian tradition of filial piety, and it remains strong in Chinese culture now. And much, as you say, less so here. I mean, King Lear and Hamlet aside, Judeo-Christian family values hold that parents and children take care of one another across the life course. And I know I was raised as a Catholic, and honor thy father and mother is one of the Ten Commandments. And the Torah and Calvinist teaching also have this as a moral imperative. And now in 2020, it feels in our secular times that all bets are off. You know, more importance is attached to individualism. It's me. What do I want? Do you agree, Rachel, that there's less stigma attached to turning your back on your parents or in the other direction, your grown children?
I do think that we are living in an extremely individualistic culture, increasingly so. So that although there is some lip service in the kind of advertising world to families helping and cheering each other on, there is also an enormous pressure on individuals to succeed personally. And I think that sits also with another value, which is about it's a very binary idea, so that you are a success or you are a loser. You are totally right or you're totally wrong. Things are very good or they're bad. And increasingly, I mean, for example, I'll give you an example, the Olympics, any Olympic reporting is often how many golds has our country got, rather than how well did you do, how amazing it is that you even turned up to the Olympics. And this has been something that we know it all around. It's like, how many golds? It's like there's in different certainly in the UK, if you look at examination results, I work with teenagers who are worried that, and this is old money in a way, that they, how many A stars did I get and not A's? And then we have even some young people worrying, what kind of an A star did I get? So did I get 97% or did I get 92%? So it becomes tinier and the margin of success is tinier and tinier and tinier. And everybody else has failed. You failed.
Gosh, it's so true. It's winner takes all. It's only the winner you ever hear about. The second runner just disappears into obscurity.
Yes. So that the fact that that person might have done really well, that they're way better than you or me at running or whatever they're doing, you only hear about that very top person. And I call that binary thinking. So it's a win or a lose, and I'm right or wrong. And what is missed is the middle ground, is not just black and white, but there's grey. And what is born out of this individualistic culture is people insisting on their rights. That, you know, I have a right for you to give me something, or I have a right for your attention, and I have a right to. No, you don't. I don't think we do in our culture. I think it's all kinds of attention. Parents and children are gifted, really, so that we are the idea that we give people attention, we give love, and then we just wait. You don't expect something back from it. So it's much more. And I'm wondering about people who have got very set in their ways because of this either or situation. And that's where estrangement happens, where somebody is saying something like, I've given all this to you and you've never given anything back to me. Well, and that's kind of showing something about. You're saying that a relationship is purely an exchange. It's purely a kind of bartering system. It isn't really like that.
But see, I was raised so that, I mean, my values, and again, I was raised as a church-going Catholic and First Communion and all of that. And the values that you held were that you loved, respected, supported your parents. It doesn't mean you didn't talk back and misbehave regularly, but you knew that, I mean, sadly, my mum and dad are both gone, but were they still here, you take care of your parents, and your parents are right to expect that if they encounter hard times when they're older and you're a successful grown-up, you will take care of them in every which way possible.
Well, I think that's a very good and noble cultural expectation, but it is that. It's an external imposition, if you like. I mean, it's something we all agree to. But my job and what I'm looking at is the internal, so that it's something that's happening on a much deeper level and it's happening on an emotional level. And those kind of I owe you, you owe me thoughts or feelings don't work as well on an emotional level. They work on a cultural level. Like, you know, if you're nice to your neighbours, they will look out for you. OK, that works on a group societal level. But actually, if you think about toddlers, you know, who scream and throw themselves on the floor, you don't say, I've raised you since babyhood, get up off that floor now. You actually accept their difficulties as part of parenting, and you pick them up, and you don't take umbrage that they are somehow wreaking
havoc.
Well,
not when they're three, of course not. You'd be very silly if you did. But you would think when someone is 32 or 34 or 28, the give and take, the reciprocity would kick in.
Well, and largely it does. That's why we're talking about this is, you know, we do hear about estrangements, but they are less common than kids that are getting on with their parents. So something has happened. And I think it builds up kind of over the years. And that's when it goes wrong. We have to go back and look at what was missed. As I keep saying, there's something being missed. And is there a possibility of going back and undoing that or understanding it more? And what are we talking about? The black and white culture. It's because people get entrenched, and children, 32-year-olds or 35-year-olds, get entrenched in you hurt me and I'm never speaking to you again ever, right, or something. And similarly, parents get entrenched, as in, you married someone I don't like, or your lifestyle is not what I wanted, or I don't like the way you spend money, or I don't like the way you've given up your church going, or whatever. And that person becomes entrenched And then it's
right.
You see what I mean? It's a kind on an emotional level, the transactional thing doesn't. I don't think it works quite in the same way. Not quite in the same
so
way.
So you both settle into your divergent tracks of path of least resistance.
What you do. That's right. Now, the question is, what can you do about that? And I think if we stand on the transactional explanation that you were just saying, like I was raised to respect my parents and they love me and then I respect them back. That isn't going to get you very far. I don't think that's a very because what it sounds like is just you're being obliged to be something. And really, we want relationships like Beth and her daughter or anybody else and their estranged child to be something that is born out of the realization of pain or hurt or misunderstanding, that it can be understood and repaired and forgiven. That's the way forward.
I guess for me, it's so hard to see because I lost my mom when I was 24. She was ill with ovarian cancer for the last 3 years of her life, and it was horrid. You know, she died in my arms. It was very, very painful. So I find all of this, it just flies in the face of my understanding of how things should be, you know, the moral imperative to, even if you don't like your parents, you would at least surely have the courtesy to call up and, even if it hurts you and you find it makes you anxious, it just, yo, what's happening? How are you? Just call. Give some sort of semblance of concern.
Yes, but that's the problem we've started with. That isn't happening. So we have to think of something else. You see what I mean? So if you start with a moral imperative and this has to be, you know, at least do the decent thing, that person is only doing it because of obligation, not because they want to.
And I guess ideally you want it to be authentic. So what's the point of cringing and saying to your partner, oh, I've got to call my mom, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, I read recently something about an estranged daughter from a mother who the mother was able to write to the daughter and say, I never found it easy being a mom. It wasn't, you know, everyone thinks you should be a good mom and I found it difficult. And I the kind of love I had for you, I was always on tenterhooks. Was I doing the right thing? And the daughter reading that thought, oh, that explains a lot. That really explains a lot. And the mom was able to do something vulnerable. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than saying, oh, come on now, you're 35. You should do this or you should do that. So it's a very difficult thing. And I think it has to start with what I would say to any parent talking to any child of any age. And that is making an open-handed gesture and seeing what happens. And if it's refused, you just do it again a little bit later and you do it again a little bit later. But you say to yourself, I did the best I could at the time. And now I'm interested to know, what is it that, you know, what could I have done differently? It's something I often talk to parents of teenagers about, what I call back foot parenting, meaning you say, now, I might be wrong about this, but did I not, you know, did I not get that right there? Or you start off by saying, I'm sorry, but I guess I missed something because perhaps I thought I was doing the best thing for you, but maybe it wasn't. Do you want to help me out with that? So you're actually inviting the young person to say, if you like, the terrible thing.
And absolving them of the guilt they might feel about feeling the way they do.
Well, whatever it is, we don't know what it is because they're not saying. And it's quite a difficult thing to do. So if somebody's saying, well, you know, when I was a teenager, you didn't pay much attention to me. You were always off doing your work, or you got divorced and you only had eyes for your new partner, which is a very common kind of thing. Instead of saying, oh, but I hadn't, defending yourself, saying, well, I didn't have much in my life, or you, why do you begrudge me a little joy? You don't do all that stuff. You say, oh, that must have been very hard for you. That's an empathy kind of question.
Yeah, sorry, so you comment. Acknowledge that feeling they have.
You do. And you say, I really need to think about that. If you're a bit taken aback, you say, I really need to think about that, giving yourself some time. Rather than what you don't say is, well, sorry, but I was doing my best. Look, I apologize. Now will you come and visit? It's way too quick.
That's never going to work.
It's not going to work. But it's because the entrenched thing. We're like, I don't want to be vulnerable. Your young person doesn't want to be vulnerable. Someone has to be willing to do that open-handed thing and see what happens. And it might be maybe through another family member. I know some estranged families can work through a brother or sister. Some can work through the other parent. So there are different ways to deal with that. Another thing I want to say, Susan, is sometimes a person, 30, 40, whatever they are, things can have not gone right for them. And what they decide to do in a quite an unconscious way is to dump all the problems on you. So very unfairly, they are going to make you the problem of that they had in their whole lives, when that may not be entirely true.
So you become the accepted scapegoat in their mind, and they only need one scapegoat. So that's it. Tough luck for you.
Exactly. So if they say, well, you know, everything that went wrong really was because you forced me to be an accountant when I never wanted to be. And if you say, no, I didn't. You really wanted to do it. You showed a lot of interest. And if I hadn't helped you, you would have done nothing with your life. Which is, that you can hear this argument, can't you? It's just, it's so, that's exactly the kind of thing that would be said. Then, first of all, you are accepting the projection, because you're accepting what they're shooting at you, which is it's all your fault because you're defending yourself. And secondly, there is no way forward for that young person to feel, a 35-year-old young person, adult, whatever, to feel you actually heard what they just said. What they said was, I feel forced into having done something because of your choices. And again, you need to stop and say, oh, that must have been really hard. I think you need to tell me a bit more about that. That's tough, because we want to be right. We just want to be, everyone wants to be right.
And you want to move it along to some sort of happy family's conclusion, which there may not be one. I want to run something by you, because I know I talked about the research that I did. I was trying to come to terms because, you know, I've been open about my own situation. I'd give anything for my mom to still be around. And heck, I probably wouldn't even be in London. I'd be living with her in my hometown in Canada, you know, doing everything with her because we got on so well. But I was shocked to find a listicle. It was titled, Seven Things You Don't Owe Your Parents. And it was quoting an American therapist. It was on the online site Bustle. And it said, the many things you don't owe your parents include time, money, a place to live, a job, your feelings, your thoughts, a shared opinion on any topic, your religious beliefs, your political beliefs, access to your children, your interests, access to your spouse or significant other, and immediate responsiveness. It left me shocked, because the therapist went on to say, you know, it's up to you. You can choose to give one more all of these, but you should feel empowered. It is your preference, your choice, and that you elect to do it because the cost of not doing it is too high. What do you think of that?
Well, that's quite an extreme way of putting it. But I would say that once your child becomes an adult, that the adult-child relationship needs as much working on and as tending as, say, in a couple or a partnership. It doesn't automatically flow that just because you have raised this young person, you could have adopted a young person, doesn't just because, you know, whether it's actually your genetic offspring or not, doesn't mean they owe you anything, actually. They don't.
So once they've fled the nest and you're not nurturing and bankrolling their every move, all bets are off. It's up to them to find a relationship with you, to keep one going, or to, if they so choose, turn their backs on you for whatever reason.
I think that is got some truth in it, but it's not just like it's all lovely. What happens is in most families, there is such a good understanding of the ups and the downs, the listening to the negative bits, the good bits, the sharing of terrible times as well as good times, is when they do get to leave, you can actually, you can be fairly sure that they will want to come back, which is individuation. But you have to be prepared for that to happen. And I think sometimes, well, as much as we try, sometimes we just really want to hold on to our kids as long as we can. And there is a process of grieving and mourning. And this is something that very big middle topic, this grieving and mourning for the loss of the young children who depended on you, or the early family life when everything was lovely, or even your married life before you were divorced. And this is that we don't grieve it and we don't allow that to be a valid grief. You just say, oh, good, that horrible thing is over now. I mean, I've spoken to many parents who are divorced, and there is still a kind of wistfulness about when they first met, about when they had a family, and now further on down the line, they have decided to live separate lives. Yes, but if there's any remaining, there was once a value, there was once a happy time. And I don't think we find it very easy to allow grief about that. And as a valid thing. So there's grief and there's loss, and we work through that. And then when you're, so my point being is that actually a lot of life is a series of little separations. It happens when your baby stops relying on you and starts running about. It happens at 5 when they go to school and they run off and don't look back. And it happens certainly as teenagers when they say, oh, get off me, mum, don't hug me, right? And we have to keep letting go a little bit, but you just manage it and you're there and you're always there for them, even if they're horrible, age 17. And then when they get to going off at 25 and not speaking to you, they have deep inside their emotional memories some idea that mom or dad are there and they will have you back. And that's, I'd say most families kind of operate like that. Somewhere, I keep coming back to the idea, when something gets missed or something is broken or something is not listened to, it's much harder for that young adult or older adult to get over those entrenched positions that they get into. So how do we deal with letting go is a massive issue in estrangement stories.
Wow. And I mean, circling back to my friend, her pain seems particularly acute because she doesn't have a real reason. She can't find one for the rift. And there's no sense that she'll ever get an explanation. So does there come to be a point of no return when you can't identify? You know, it'd be so good if there was one blow up nuclear event and she could say, well, that's when the disconnect happened. But she can't find any explanation for her daughter's ambivalence towards her. So is there a point where you just have to break free and live your life and not let this open wound color your life? I mean, I don't want to paint my friend as a sad sack. She goes on exotic trips and does a lot of international volunteering and does all kinds of things. You know, she doesn't mope around, but you can see that there's sort of a sad ebullience there, you know?
Yes, it's very painful for her. And I wouldn't, I guess, you know, as I said, this is my work and my job as a therapist to sit down with people like Beth and say, let's have a big think about all of this. And that might be helpful for her to ask herself some questions about, you know, what was life like growing up with them? Not perhaps in the very simple black and white terms. I gave them lots of love and then we divorced and then their dad gave them lots of money. But so, the much more subtle strands. One place I find is very useful to start when I'm working with parents and children is to look at the parents' own parents. So I'd like to know about her husband's mum and dad, about her mum and dad, about what their expectations were of who owes what to whom. What do you do with families?
I know he came from a very traditional Spanish family. He loved his mum. You know, the mom ruled, loved his mum. And I do know a little bit about Beth's mother, very aloof. Never hugged her. So Beth says she did the reverse. She was constantly hugging and I love you to her kids. And yes, of course you can have your friend over. And in listening to her, I always thought it was the disunity that was presented to the children. So they just got mixed messages.
Yes, it sounds like one person was saying one thing, another. But also when I'm fascinated by genetics and inherited characteristics, if you have an aloof mom of Beth and you also have a dad who perhaps we're speculating that he's kind of, you know, this is how it should be, very have strong opinions, then those two bits of genetic material come down and turn her and result in a daughter who perhaps doesn't want hugs. Maybe she felt that was being over nurtured or micromanaging or just get out of my hair. And so sometimes our hopes and wishes from our own previous experiences can clash with our own children.
Wow. So the daughter may be more like Beth's mom.
Could be. this is what's the so fascinating thing, to sit down. And generally, if you're doing it in a kind and compassionate and curious way, most people find that process quite useful and helpful, like Beth or any other estranged mum or dad, to sit down and say, look, we're not talking about blame and who should or shouldn't do things. We're trying to understand, firstly, what happened in our family now that's resulted in this estrangement. But let's go back a bit. What other thoughts and feelings and influences have come down to make us the people we are? And that is, it's like one of those archaeological digs you see on television, and when it all pieces together and we could begin to see how this puzzle fits. And, right. Do you know what? I mean, people, when you go back generations where people have been through wars and have suffered deprivations, and how that influences their parenting and down the line, is fascinating.
Fascinating indeed. And no, I have to thank you so much. I mean, my Google library, by the way, also led me to the very apt opening line of Anna Karenina: happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. I mean, it's very layered. It's very complicated.
Yes, that's a beautiful quote, isn't it? It shows that we have to take each person differently. So in a way, when we're having this conversation today, we're looking for commonalities, aren't we? And I guess the answer is yes, there are some. But the real work of mending some of these estrangements are looking in a careful and kind and supportive way at what happened for us. What were the good bits? What the bits that might have gone wrong? Many times for very good reasons, like there's illness, there's upset, there's things happen to people in people's lives. You know, you have to move countries where you didn't want to, or someone got sick at the wrong time, or you hoped to have a baby and you didn't, or someone's mother or father died just at a very crucial moment. Lots and lots and lots of things that happen which result in us getting stuck in these ways. But I deeply believe that there are ways out of them if the will is there.
Yeah, and if you've got enough time, you know, because, I mean, this has been going on for years. So I suppose you just set your cap and hope that it cycles back to some sort of connection, and every overture is not met with silence. I really appreciate this, Rachel. I've learned a lot. And hopefully when my friend Beth and my other two friends listen to this, they will thank us for doing this, because your professional insights have really shed some great light on family estrangement issues.
Yes, we certainly could carry on this conversation for hours. But I guess I just want to finish by saying, if we can just have the will to look a bit more closely at things, there may be surprising opening up of relationships. And I suppose lastly, I'd say, you know, you're talking about Beth and it going on for years, that is, we need to say to ourselves, you know, look after yourself. If someone's not speaking to you, it's kind of, and you're not going to investigate it, then we have to say, I did the best I could at the time, and I rest with that, and let my little bird that has flown away fly around the world a bit more perhaps, until we meet again.
Oh, that's lovely. That's really beautiful. Thank you so much for that. And I have to say, this, you know, speaking with you feels like a bit of a family reunion. I used to host a show, a daily radio show in Switzerland, and the highlight of my week was the strand that we did together. It was called Kids in Mind. Listeners loved it.
Yes, that was such a good time, wasn't it, Susan? Really missed that a lot. Really was great fun to do it and to hear people's reactions. Everybody, I think, from people who had children, even through to people who didn't. And people just interested, because it when we start thinking about children and teenagers, we obviously think about ourselves, don't we, growing up. And that was a fun time, which I hope we helped a lot of people out there.
Well, I hope we can help some more, because you have kindly agreed to be my resident psychotherapist. So we're going to get some ideas from you, dear listener. What topic pertinent to the big middle years, you know, big changes happening then, 40s through 70s and transitions. What would you like Rachel and I to dig into next? You can drop me a mail, susan@susanflory.com. And also, while you're hanging around and listening to the back catalog, please, pretty please, subscribe, rate, and review The Big Middle on Apple Podcasts. I know I seldom make what has become the cliche call to action of every potter out there. But potential sponsors tell me they like to see the reviews. So thank you so much in advance if you can add yours to the queue. You can also leave a review on my website. That's susanflory.com. And comment on this conversation or any of the others on the respective show pages. Until next time, thank you so much for your company. Bye-bye, Rachel.
Bye-bye, Susan. It's always a pleasure, and really looking forward to our next conversation.